This is Uncle Don here on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia, with my 319th opening of the Porcupine Petting Zoo. What do you do to protect your neighborhood if you live in a remote community an hour's drive away from the nearest police force? Here are two local examples of how people in such areas, about equally distant from the Prince George RCMP detachment, dealt with miscreants. The first incident was a couple of decades ago in a lakeside residential area where one of my co-workers lived. They were plagued by punks driving wildly pickup trucks and ATVs, tearing up lawns and vandalizing property. Every time police were called, the offenders were gone before one could attend. One day, some fed-up locals caught a couple of the young men and hung a licking on them. The police were again called, only to arrest the vigilantes. I don't know where the case ended, except that my acquaintance lost his job over it. The establishment doesn't tolerate vigilantism, even when the law is helpless against offenders. The second event occurred in a small town, also about an hour out of Prince George. A couple of men living in a rented house were caught robbing the freezer on the porch of a resident. The police were called, not by the resident, but by the thieves. Some 30 locals surrounded their house, and the men were afraid for their lives. They called the cops to rescue them, and they were escorted away, never to be seen there again. Someone else came to clean out the house. The difference was that the second community had a rural crime watch with a telephone net, so a group could be assembled rapidly to respond to a problem. They didn't have to resort to violence. By sheer numbers, they intimidated miscreants, solving their problem. Either I misheard or Joe Biden misspoke. I thought he said the United States could not interfere with Israel's sovereign right to attack Iran. Israel is a member of the United Nations. As such, it has adopted the United Nations Charter as a supreme element of its domestic law. Article 4, Section 4 of Article 2 of that document reads, "All members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or independence of any state or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the United Nations." Just because the State of Israel has a record of ignoring treaties, resolutions of the UN Security Council, and international law in general, does not make further violations a sovereign right. If Israel has this sovereign right to attack Iran, is Joe Biden implying the United States would have a similar sovereign right to attack, say, Canada? The precedent has been set with Bush's gratuitous invasion of Iraq. Does Canada have the same right to attack the U.S.? Okay, how about Spain? No, scratch that. Monaco? Palau? I hope that some future clarification on this right of nations. Ah, summertime. Time to jump on a big old jet and head for distant places. Whether we're off to the hurricane belt for a nice sunburn or off to Paris for a lesson in rudeness, we can hardly get away from old PG without flying. Take your choice of WestJet or Air Canada, but when I have my druthers, I opt for WestJet. I've tried to adjust to the treatment I get nowadays on the remnant of the company once part mine, way back when Brian Mulroney earned his bribes by buying those Airbuses. When flying the new privatized Air Canada, I just think of all the wondrous air miles, not kilometers, I can earn jammed into a miniature seat and steerage. But I can't help wondering whether I'm one of those jazz planes from which they removed life jackets to save weight. Say, what else in a plane is real heavy and can be eliminated? How about some of that bulky old jet fuel? I wonder whether the pilot is one of those disgruntled folk who got screwed on seniority when Air Canada absorbed Canadian Pacific Airlines, or whatever became of the wondrous meals we once feasted upon, and why a stale sandwich costs a few bucks, or if the mechanics working on my plane might have been more concerned about their gutted pension fund than whether all those fittings are tight. Say, what's that funny noise? Coming soon, if Air Canada's management has its way, aircraft maintenance in El Salvador. Now, I have nothing against Salvadorans, although most of the ones I've ever seen were carrying submachine guns. Were all of the Boeing and Airbus maintenance manuals adequately translated into Spanish? And was that task contracted to the lowest bidder? My wife and I visited El Salvador. Nice place, I guess. I don't know, as we never got outdoors. For our holidays in 1986, we decided to join adventurous types visiting revolutionary Nicaragua. Our circuitous route took us from Prince George through Vancouver through Toronto to Miami. In Miami, we boarded a TACA plane, Transportes Aeronaves de Centroamerica. Because American-sponsored mercenary armies were at war against Nicaragua, there were no direct flights. We had to change planes in El Salvador. We knew this flight would be different when we saw people packing all manner of stuff into the cabin, like television sets and other bulky goods. We had asked for non-smoking, or were told with a grin that they would seat the two of us together and that would be non-smoking. On arriving in San Salvador, our connection to Managua was waiting. Transferring passengers were herded through a tunnel between planes, overseen every few meters by glaring armed soldiers. That was my introduction to El Salvador, then one of those tame American-run dictatorships specializing in torture, disappearances, and massacres of their people. Charming place. This was not the end, as we arrived in Managua to find that one of our three suitcases was missing. It was the one packed with stuff in short supply in Nicaragua, like pencils, school supplies, and first aid kits. We learned later that bags were systematically stripped of useful stuff between planes in San Salvador. As I said, I have nothing against Salvadorians, but I won't claim that my brush with their country left a good taste in my mouth. Here's another item from the We Don't Have to Obey the Rules, We're the Government file. Infrastructure projects included in Canada's economic stimulus program are of such urgency that up to 14,000 of them will be exempted from legally mandated environmental assessments. Note that this massive sidestepping of normal standards was not approved by Parliament, but by Harper's cabinet, which means effectively the Prime Minister himself. The judgment of the Sierra Club and EcoJustice is that the federal government is getting out of the environmental assessment game. No more worries when roads, sewage plants, bridges, and such are built under this blanket order. Why waste time, effort, and money on studies of potential environmental damage? There's plenty more environment where that came from, so why be fussy? Wildlife, fish, air, and water quality can't stand in the way of Canadian progress anymore. After all, what potential destruction could compare with the massive affront to nature in tar sands mining? A few polluted rivers or poisoned wells are nothing when compared to the urgency of getting money into the hands of construction companies and financiers. This is just another case of Stockwell Day's belief that it doesn't matter what we do to the planet, as Jesus is coming, and he'll fix everything. Today we hear about BRIC, and it means Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Back in the 70s, British Columbia had a different BRIC. That was the British Columbia Resources Investment Corporation. That BRIC was a product of the newly elected Social Credit government, defeaters of Dave Barrett's NDP. It bundled a number of government-owned companies under one corporate umbrella and gave every British Columbian 5 free shares. They sold extra shares for $6 each, with 5,000 share limits per person. At that time, I lived in Victoria next to a retired Salvation Army officer. He told me he was going to use his savings to invest the maximum, some $30,000, a lot of money in those days. I tried to dissuade him, but he declared that he trusted his government and the Social Credit Party, and he knew they wouldn't screw him. Those shares traded widely, rising to $9 each at one point. Then they fell and fell and fell, as one by one the companies they represented were mismanaged or looted and went belly up. I suppose you can still find BRIC stock certificates in antique shops and collections of artifacts, but they're worthless, as dead as the Social Credit Party that printed them. I don't know where my neighbor is now, probably dead, but I'm sure his investment soured him on the provincial government he so trusted. A purported sign of green shoots in the economy is the number of people losing their jobs each month is falling. Not that employment is recovering, but that unemployment is rising more slowly. Talk about grasping at straws. In keeping with the smiley face shown by governments, this is sold as good news. Don't worry, be happy, your job may come back in 2014. The figures are daunting, especially if you're one of those thrown on the street or out there looking for a job. But official numbers are fudged. So far, some 130,000 workers, many of whom would otherwise have lost employment, are still technically employed, though through a government program supplementing wages of those moved from full-time to part-time. I don't doubt that this is a valuable program, maintaining skilled workers for employers while allowing beneficiaries to take home the bacon. My problem is with the hiding in this government-subsidized partial unemployment. Would it not be reasonable to figure that a full-time worker cut back from 5 to 3 days is now 40% unemployed? That would give a clearer picture of the impact of our recession. And how about those who lost jobs and now claim to be self-employed? Many workers dumped from payrolls who describe themselves as self-employed may be in denial to themselves or may be ashamed to admit to pollsters that they are without work. We cannot sustain an economy by taking in each other's laundry or selling one another Mary Kay products, and we should not lie to ourselves about the extent of this recession's effects on real people. Barack Obama has passed 6 months in power, and I have given him a free ride so far. Time's up. No longer can we blame all the ills of the world on George Wanker Bush, as he's safely off the stage. Obama inherited the wars against Iraq and Afghanistan, but the mess in Pakistan is his, and he'll have to wear its consequences. The wisdom of sending drone airplanes to rain hell with the well-named Hellfire missiles is lost on me. The ratio of innocents to so-called militants is staggering. Consequent fear and hatred engendered amongst survivors will haunt the United States for a long time. Obama inherited Bush's massive rescue package for the financial industry, but it was under his watch that funds were diverted to massive bailouts of auto companies. If the gamble on Chrysler and GM comes a cropper, it's Obama who will wear the blame for pouring billions down a rat hole. Obama has chosen to place yet another patch on an old tire in his repairs to the chaotic American medical system when the whole wheel needs to be replaced. Granted that he faces massive entrenched insurance, pharmaceutical, and medical industries feeding on the current anarchy with their army of lobbyists and fleet of bought and paid for politicians, but the fact remains that he leaves the flimsy structure intact. As the weeks and months unfold, we'll see more of the underbelly of the Obama administration. I fervently hope that the press of individuals will not be reluctant to speak out on its failings just because he's better than the unlamented George Wanker Bush, Dick Cheney's sock puppet. We shouldn't be afraid to learn from those whose systems and beliefs differ from ours. After all, didn't we learn a lot about torture from the Nazis, the Soviets, and the Israelis? This time it is newly capitalist Russia to which we might look for guidance. As of the 1st of July, all casinos and slot machine parlors across that vast land were closed by fiat of Vladimir Putin. Naturally, the New York Times bemoans this draconian measure under the headline, Job Losses. According to this august paper, there will be 400,000 people thrown mercilessly onto Russian streets. The insidious gambling racket has proliferated in the post-Soviet era, and Putin's government wants to nip it now before it gets further entrenched. The Russian economy is so opaque that we cannot predict what will become of the people losing work in the gambling business. Maybe the whole works will go underground to be run by the mafia. We can't tell from here. Let's say that all Canadian gambling dens, casinos, and bingo halls were closed overnight. Imagine all the slots and video lottery terminals were recycled, racetrack betting eliminated, and lottery tickets pulled from every convenience store and gas station in the land. Then what? If gambling were restored as an offense to our criminal code, the immediate effects would hit a lot of people, but at least our legal system would be able to deal with any moves to large-scale underground gambling. Proponents of betting claim that thousands of marginal businesses rely on gambling revenue to stay afloat. Maybe. So? Is it a public obligation to support every business that survives by feeding a vice? If we accept this argument, perhaps we should let them sell heroin and crack cocaine to support their fragile businesses. Gambling enthusiasts look only at the immediate downside of choking off this activity. What about the positive? All of those fancy casinos and bingo halls could be remodeled as housing developments for the homeless. That would be a nice start to solving two social problems at once. And how about all of that money casually dropped on bets and lottery tickets? Would it just evaporate? No. People would still have those dollars so thoughtlessly squandered to use for food, clothing, shelter, and entertainment. Instead of leaving bundles of money in the casino, people could travel, go to restaurants, attend concerts, the movies, or even pay off those damn credit card debts. Personal bankruptcies would decrease as those now forcing destitution onto their families would have to find new vices. With money diverted from gambling, businesses receiving new spending would have to hire staff and buy supplies. Manufacturers would make the goods and farmers grow the food. reduce debt sometimes thoughtlessly built up through gambling, would divert funds now going to interest toward consumption. All this would bring job opportunities in the real economy for those formerly peddling dreams of winnings. Yes, dreams. Remember that those fancy casinos and bingo hall rents are paid for by losers, not winners. All in all, eliminating gambling might be a positive stimulus package as soon as the initial shock of readjustment were absorbed. It would certainly set a healthy example, prompting young people to save for the future instead of building plans around the fantasy of elusive lottery winnings. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. While I'm on devices, how about tobacco? There's one I know intimately, as I took up smoking at around 14 and quit the demon weed, finally and for a second time, at the tender age of 25. I went through hell kicking an addiction while I was in the service, but got started again 2 years later in college. I was in an auto accident, and in the confusion, someone handed me a cigarette, and I was right back where I started at 2 packs a day. It was hell all over again quitting the second time. So those of you who don't smoke, forget the cool image the ads portray. You don't suck on the cigarette. It sucks on you. It sucks your money, your health, and your self-esteem as an addict. A World Health Organization report carries some surprising figures. About 80% of all smokers live in developing countries. In some underdeveloped nations, including Bangladesh, Indonesia, Mexico, and Egypt, the poorest smokers may spend as much as 15% of their incomes on tobacco. Such a burden drives them further into poverty at the same time as it ruins their health. WHO estimates that 5 million people die of tobacco-related illnesses each year. If it weren't so sick, it would be amusing that government representatives are in Geneva now, intent upon developing an international protocol on tobacco products. This protocol would not address problems of addiction, but the growth of illegal supplies, sometimes smuggled and often counterfeit. Those people are concerned solely about the loss of government taxation revenues. Here in Canada, advertising of tobacco is controlled, except for promotional leakage from across our southern border. British Columbia has forced retailers to hide their products from the eyes of impressionable youth, but drive past any high school and see clusters of kids being cool by smoking off grounds. I have hope that smoking is gradually dying out, at least in developed countries. With its ban in public places and control of sales, we may see the time when a lighted cigarette is a source of amusement and scorn. There are some positive trends in the world, after all. I don't want to be tarred with intimations of optimism just because I see a single spark of good. We may eliminate the scourges of tobacco and gambling only to see our civilization wither under the attack of an unforgiving nature. We are inexorably screwing ourselves. Everyone outside the Fraser Institute, the fossil fuel industries, their lobbyists, and purchased politicians knows that we are headed straight toward catastrophe. Earth's atmosphere and oceans cannot absorb increases in carbon dioxide without triggering devastating changes. I'm preaching to the choir on this one. We all know it. But who's making the adjustments that would prevent it? Experts tell us we have to cut emissions by roughly 80% immediately if we want to forestall catastrophe. With some 200 separate nations competing economically, which among them will commit fiscal suicide by shutting down industry to meet that 80% target, while others eat their lunch? We're approaching tipping points where changes caused by human activity gain a momentum that will continue even if our emissions cease. The melting of ice caps and glaciers appears to have passed such a tipping point, as exposed seas and land absorb energy previously reflected back into space. What's the rational response to the situation? We know that there's no hope of halting the process unless all nations coordinate efforts drastically and immediately. We know further that chances of this happening are zip, zero. The only thing that could conceivably bring such an international cooperation would be a disaster so universal and so devastating that as to indicate that it was too late to act. This tells me that Stephen Harper's regime is on the only rational path. It feigns cooperation and reduction of pollutants, while surreptitiously allowing us to careen toward inevitable disaster. This is truly a case of eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. If the asteroid is going to land in your backyard, don't waste your time trying to stop it. Sit back and have a beer. the human race is headed for extinction, or at least a reduction to such a miserable rump as to no longer be a burden to our planet. It was a noble experiment in evolution, proving that too much intelligence invested in one species leads to disaster. Like 99% of all species that have ever roamed the Earth, we will one day be gone. It's a pity that we're taking so many innocents with us. The phrase war on terror has gone out of fashion, but reaction to terror incidents remains punitive, not preventive. This isn't just futile, but dangerous as to society, as the law evolves from catching perpetrators after their acts to pursuing their preparations. Thus, we see police agents infiltrating groups to spy and, in many cases, demonstrate their reliability by aiding, participating, and precipitating illegal acts. The Toronto 12, those guys who talked of blowing up Parliament and beheading our dear leader, were aided and abetted by a police agent who arranged for the delivery of dummy explosives. Without his provocation, might these people have remained a frustrated but harmless bunch of bullshit artists? We've gone beyond provocation to incriminating thoughts. One Canadian has been subject to restraints because he was seen as a sympathizer of terrorists. Once sympathy is criminalized, how far are authorities allowed to go in ferreting out sympathies? Here we go into gross violations of privacy as cops snoop into our communications and delve further into our private lives. You don't have to live in Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union to see actions deterred by fear of government. My mother-in-law was horrified to hear that my wife and I were involved in a Prince George demonstration. She said that we could get on a list. A list? What list? And whose list? She had lived through the McCarthy era when phantom lists were sources of terror among a populace fed on stories of ubiquitous domestic communists intent upon enslaving us all. People whose names appeared on lists lost jobs, homes, friends, and sometimes their very freedom. The fear of the 50s was palpable, and its shadow lives with us still. Fear of attracting unfavorable attention is not just a fading artifact, it's a tool of control. In a society where law is supposed to be paramount, governments cannot control an entire population with brute violence. Force is reserved for the underclass and racial minorities. It's not necessary to beat and torture your citizenry if you can keep them fearful, fearful of anything if it drives them to cleave to government for protection. In my lifetime, we've seen popular objects of fear morph seamlessly from communism after the Soviet Revolution, through fascism in the 40s, back to communism, and on through the horror of possible nuclear war. With the collapse of the communist bloc, there was a mad scramble to find another boogeyman. Crime and drugs filled the bill until Osama bin Laden was gracious enough to give us the shock of a hole in Midtown Manhattan. George Wanker Bush put that hole to good use as justification for his wars against Afghanistan, then Iraq. With memories of communism, nuclear bombs, and the World Trade Crater fading, other rationalizations are needed for government control. Economic collapse gave them cover for massive movement of public resources to private sector under the guise of stimulus. With the world economy supposedly climbing out of a hole, they're back to cultivating the fear of terrorism. We don't want to look at terrorism as a symptom. Attacking phenomena without considering causes is like going after cholera while ignoring contaminated water. And there are two kinds of terrorism. We'll always have crazies with us expressing their madness through destruction. Their bombings, shootings, assassinations, and such constitute background noise in any society. Then there's the terrorism perpetrated by those responding to perceived injustices. Authorities don't want to look at their motivations. Right now, a frantic search is on for the bomber of natural gas facilities around Dawson Creek. Little attention is paid to what drove this man, woman, or group to use explosives to express frustration. Because our land ownership rights don't extend to the subsurface, governments have been merrily selling off ownership of the land under the feet of locals. Corporations have mined the land and drilled for gas and oil with minimal restraint, pissing off those subjected to the invasion with its pollution, noise, and traffic interrupting their lives. There's a spirit of non-cooperation alive up there as frustrated cops increasingly invade privacy. Is anyone seriously looking at withdrawing from activities driving this sabotage, so easily classed as terrorism? Hello out there, is government listening? Are the corporations listening? No, get the terrorist and everything will be fine. We know Encana will not quit. We know our government will not force this corporation to cease offensive activities. In this battle between citizen rights and money, money will trump, and in the final analysis, all the sabotage in the world will not stop it. Surely the bomber doesn't really believe that his efforts will bear fruit, making his efforts seem poignantly futile. Anger has pushed the perpetrator beyond reason. And so it seems with other reactions to perceived injustices. On the island of Bali, terrorists attacked nightclubs frequented by foreign tourists. This was not a random act, but a reaction to an invasion of drunks, flagrantly violating the norms of a conservative Muslim society. The government of Indonesia had winked at this as it brought money into the economy. Ah, there's the usual suspect again. Money. Also in Indonesia this week, two tourist hotels in Jakarta were bombed. Surviving perpetrators are pursued, but their motivation is buried. Were these particular establishments chosen as targets because they were frequented by foreigners drinking forbidden alcohol while cavorting half-naked in a conservative Muslim nation? While the provocations continue, violence will follow. But do you see the hidden villain? Tourist money for corporations and their friends in government. A radical remedy for terrorism, as currently defined, would be the devolution of power from irresponsible corporations and governments to citizens. It's axiomatic that people whose needs are met, whose aspirations are attainable, and whose sensibilities are not offended will not lash out in frustration. No, we needn't cater to every popular whim. Yes, people's concerns should be addressed in a democratic forum. Yes, they should believe that they can find satisfaction within their societies. And yes, the powerful will have to yield a measure, a goodly measure of power and wealth in order to buy peace and tranquility. Will this come to pass? Get serious. We'll continue to sacrifice our rights, freedoms, and resources in search of the elusive terrorist, batting one down after another while another arises. I see these actions akin to punching a balloon. Humans seldom learn lessons when a profit is to be made by ignoring them. This has been the 319th edition of the Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. And here's today's hint, health tip from Uncle Don's medicine chest. It's been proven by health professionals that breakfast is the most important beer of the day.